today. Will Boris be blamed? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with both an Australian, New Zealand and global perspective. And today I'm joined again by Joe Wilkes. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Martin. Hey, dude.
Pretty good. Now we're going to look at the UK.
Yeah, I thought we haven't looked at the UK for a long time since we did our first post together when I met you in your kitchen back then. Didn't have this flash background when we last spoke. And I just thought we'd go back and look at the UK. I think for the last two or three years, there's been so much, confusion around the Brexit debacle. Whether you agree with Brexit or disagree with Brexit, ultimately it will be used as a scapegoat for the credit challenges that Europe and Britain are facing. And I don't think it's really talked about because we get so distracted by, Brexit's going to mean the end of the world, that actually we forget that part of the underlying challenge in the UK is that the credit impulse has remained very, very weak now for a decade. Mm. And with the exception of a couple of years in sort of 13, 14, 15, early 16, we've struggled to get credit moving up, largely because people are just maxed out. Now, the UK is a really interesting example because the banking system needs high asset prices to function, and it needs to maintain those high asset prices because if house prices fall, and we've talked about the building guarantees to the home builders and the various equity schemes and the first home buyer grants and all of that. But if the prices fall, then their equity positions change. Now, over the last few years, the volumes of house sales in the UK have been managed, I'd say managed at a fairly steady crap level by the blocks that were put on the freedom of the market to move if they were given more opportunity to. I think that stamp duty in the UK is a wonderful barrier for transactions taking place because, I was over there, I moved to New Zealand in 2017, but I was looking at, okay, well, I could move to my next property, but do you know what? I've got to go and borrow a bit more money to do that. And by the time I just actually play with the transaction, I could be looking at £30,000 or £40,000 worth of tax, which takes me a long time to save, and I'm just giving it to the government for the pleasure of moving. So a lot of older people look at that and say, well, I'm not going to downsize and pay the government £40,000 for the pleasure of doing it. I'll stay where I am. And a lot of people looking to upsize look at the market and say, well, I'm not going to go and upsize because I'm not going to pay £40,000 to the government just for the pleasure of having an extra bedroom that I use three times a year. So you've just got this transactional block. And as a result, the UK economy has struggled to create credit privately and has relied, therefore, on the growth in government debt and spending and off balance sheet activities and all the misfeasance. But it does appear at the moment that we're going through a turn in that UK cycle. And typically when you see a correction in house prices, and I think that's where we're now leading. In London, the top end of the market's been affected for a few years anyway, albeit it's largely been unreported. The average prices going up from the bottom and sort of concertina effect coming from the top, but more transactions at the bottom going up have outweighed the fewer volumes of sales at the top to give an overall boost to the average for the reporting practices. But we're now seeing an unusual spring, and Brexit will be blamed, and poor old Boris will get the can, and he's under a lot of pressure minute stepping into number 10 to try and do something about it. But really, ultimately, it's about credit growth. Now, if you look at the volumes of sales taking place in the UK, and we touched on this on the last post, but just as a recap, HMRC data shows that there are 84,490 residential sales on a seasonally adjusted basis during June, which was down 9.6% on a monthly basis from May. Now, June transactions, when I was operating in real estate in the UK, June transactions were normally from a really busy March and April, where that's your spring boom coming into Easter. That was one of normally the two or three busiest months of the year in terms of deals agreed. They then complete in June. Now, That drop-off's quite telling. The figure was actually lower on a non-adjusted basis at 83,750, down 13.6% compared with May, and all regions in the UK experienced a drop for the third consecutive month. The largest annual decline in volumes of sales was in Wales, with sales falling 43.9%, Martin. I mean, that's an enormous June-to-June change. And annually, June to June change, down to 2,840. Northern Ireland registered a 30.7% drop June to June in terms of volume of sales to 1,870. So that's actually quite a big reduction in the amount of credit that's going to be filtering into those markets and those economies locally. Transactions in England and Scotland were both down 24% annually to 70,920, 8,120 respectively. So you've got Brexit maybe causing a little bit of uncertainty about whether people are going to be on the market and whether they're going to give it a go. But really, I think we have to look back at just the recovery in house prices over the last few years in some of the parts of the country, and the fact that we're now back at a level where the stagnant wage growth can't support the debt growth to go and kind of allow people to buy. Inner London home sales, and this has come from Wall Street, they plunged, 3-month moving average, they plunged back to a level last month in terms of volumes of sales that hasn't been seen since June 2009. And I remember June 2009, 3 months after Lehman Brothers, where in the end of March, I had a sales book of deals agreed, which had pretty much halved by the time we got to June 2009. So it wasn't about lack of stock. The stock was rising, but there was a confidence issue. And I just wonder whether we're seeing this at the moment playing out in the UK, and the Brexit is going to be the thing that will be blamed. What are your views?
Well, there's clearly people are looking for an alibi or something that they can actually say, you know, as John Adams will say, plausible deniability. It's nothing to do with us. It's over there. It's them, you know. And so I think Brexit is one of those things which will probably get blamed for a lot of things, despite the fact, of course, it was created by the Conservative Party essentially making dumb decisions earlier on and then essentially not managing it effectively for, you know, 3 or 4 years. They'll probably blame everybody else but themselves. But of course, the truth is that the underlying issues relate to credit availability, and all of those things, and the central bank's moves to drive rates lower and lower and lower to try and maintain momentum in the economy. And so, in a way, people will be looking for anything but the real culprit, which is effectively poor central bank policy and, frankly, the concept of using credit to drive the economy and housing sector to drive the economy rather than for productive purposes. But of course, nobody ever talks about that.
No, we seem to be one of a few voices at the market talking about it. It is quite telling that so many of these booms that we're talking about in Australia, we're talking about in New Zealand, and Australia and New Zealand don't have Brexit to contend with. So it's really interesting when you look at the comparative transaction drop-off. The UK volume of sales in March of the last few years have closed by the end of May, because you can see that spike at the end of 2016, 142,209 sales closed by the end of May in the UK. By 2017, that number had gone down to 92,846. It mirrors what's happened in Auckland. In 2018, 85,498. Auckland took a little dip up because last year was our rush to beat the foreign buyer ban. And then this year in the UK, 74,503 sales, again, a drop-off. So there's less credit being created. And, you know, we're going to blame Brexit and Boris. It'll be bloody Boris's fault. And I quite like Boris. I think it's quite funny. Maybe that's because I grew up watching him on Have I Got News For You? But he's going to get the can unless there's a way that policy can be turned around. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if they do go through some changes in the stamp duty rules in the UK. It's going to affect the government's tax take. But what's more important, the creation of new debt in the economy to keep everything going, or the tax, because with these drop-offs in volumes, there's not going to be much tax if it continues.
Well, actually, there is, if you like, a moral hazard question here, right? Because it's central banks around the world that have been doing the heavy lifting for a decade, and they've taken rates lower and lower and lower in an attempt to try and stimulate the economy and get inflation to those target ranges, which are, wherever, whatever you think about those targets, that's what they're shooting for. But in a way, the more that central banks have tried to do that, it's got politicians off the hook. Because essentially, they can say, well, it's central bank's fault, not our fault, right? And I think there's now, we're getting to the point where effectively all of those strategies from central banks are running out of smoke. And essentially, it's time for politicians to do the job that they should have been doing for a decade, which is to try and think differently about how to drive the economy. The question is, are they capable of doing it? And do they know what levers to pull? But at the moment, my view is that there is a massive moral hazard simply because of the way that central banks have operated. And in fact, that has really been one of the root causes of the fundamental issues that we've got, not just in Australia or New Zealand and in the UK, but pretty much in all Western economies.
I genuinely don't think that politicians are capable, Martin. I'm going to send you a clip of somebody who is a politician in the UK. Thankfully, she's not in government at the moment, but just running through her math skills. I think you'll find it funny. Diane Abbott, who's of the Labour Party. Because if that's the measure of the politicians that we've got in the UK, we're stuffed. But anyway, it's quite interesting when you talk about the, we've talked about the spoiking of the regions, and in Australia it was, couldn't spoik Perth because Perth's been falling for 4 years, so it was Hobart, and you've got to go and buy an investment property in Hobart. When you look at the end of these cycles, you can see that it is the peripheral areas that go up the most. I mean, the drop-off in Northern Ireland that we just talked about in terms of transaction volumes last month, sales prices annually have gone up 3.5%. The drop-off in sales volumes, maybe there's a shortage of property, but that's gone and pushed up. The fact that then you then have that cut-off in the number of transactions will have this pull-off later. And I've got a little chart that just shows the way that prices have moved and recovered around the regions. And some of the regions in the UK, West Midlands, the east of England, you go to the northwest, Yorkshire and the Humber, the pace of recovery, and this is in an environment where interest rates went from over 5% to 0.5% at the central bank, and where mortgage rates dropped from 4 and 5 and mid 5%. All the way down to 1.5%, you can get mortgage money in the UK now, and yet the growth has been anemic in many of the parts of the country that were late to the last cycle. They've been the last to recover, and it's going to be interesting to see where they go next.
Yeah, well, I often say the property market is not a single market, it's a bunch of different markets with some different dynamics. But I agree with you, it's often the smaller markets, the peripheral markets, that come to it late, hang on a bit longer, but ultimately when they drop more. And I suspect we're going to see more of that ahead.
Yeah, I think they're the markets where people tend to get stuck for longer. And you and John have done some very good work on Western Australia with the Mandurah post that you put in. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but there was a chap who commented and has posted an article on Mandurah specifically and highlighting the last 10 sales that have been made in Mandurah. Phenomenal the length of time that people have held properties to make a loss. I think there was, the people who actually made a return on their property purchase in Mandurah had been 15, 16 years ago that they bought them. Anyone who bought really from 2009, 10 was sitting on fairly heavy losses.
Right, but remember, of course, also that that doesn't include the ongoing maintenance and running costs of the property that
Nor
you
the
have,
impact of inflation.
nor the impact of inflation. And that's one of the things that I think so many people forget, right? So they see this theoretical increase even in the capital value, right? But you've got to be very careful because if you take all of the costs of the property involved, it doesn't look very good at all. And my calculations through my models suggest that in fact the overall gains from property, even over an extended period, are still pretty low. And whilst those capital gains are still being quoted dramatically, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, when you add everything else in, it's not looking very flash at all. So I think people need to be a bit more careful about assuming that property is this magic pudding that we shall always return, because the truth is rather different.
Yeah, and you like us in the UK, have that stamp duty as part of the transactional cost. Australia estate agent fees, I've never really understood why they are so high, because from my view, the business model is completely inefficient compared to how it is operated in the UK. Lots and lots of people doing the same thing, because the franchise owners aren't having to pay a base salary to anybody. So what you get is lots and lots of part-timers doing the business and selling one or two houses a year. But they're not experts on the market, and they don't really know what's going on. And as a result, the consumer pays for that on top of your stamp duty as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how this pans out. But I thought we'd just bring the UK back in for a discussion, having done our discussion on it previously.
Well, it's good to know that, Joe. Thank you very much for your time again and for that information. And I guess we'll keep chatting about the property market until we get banned.
Absolutely.
See you next time.
Take care, mate.
So there you have it. I think Joe makes some really important points there. And just to underscore, the overall returns from property over the long term are nowhere near those that are often quoted. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.